So in your case, I assume that you're just going to brick it up then, Matt. Is that what you're suggesting?
Mine's already bricked up. There are no windows in my garage, so
okay.
I just need to worry about my leaky garage door. So if anybody's, that limp mass that you were talking about seems like something I need to, I don't know that I want to Google limp mass though. I might need a search filter.
You've got to be very careful, very careful.
Hello and welcome to the AV Forum's Home AV podcast for Monday the 15th of April. And joining me on this edition is Martin Dew. Hi, Martin.
Hi.
And we've got Mart Isengruber. I've said that wrong, haven't I? Isengruber.
Isengruber.
I knew I was going to get it wrong. I'll get it wrong every time. That'll be the catchphrase, I think, going forward. And of course, our special guest today is Neil Davidson. Welcome back to the podcast, Neil.
Hi, Phil.
Right, so what are we talking about this week? Well, not a lot, really. There's just the one sort of major subject that we're going to talk about, but it is the most important thing when it comes to your system, and that's not the gear or anything else that you put into your room. It's the room itself, so we're going to discuss that this afternoon in our podcast here. We're also going to quickly touch on an open house event that's happening in Newcastle. Something happened in the northeast of England, wow. And what is waveforming? No idea. We're going to talk about it a bit later and discuss it and tell you exactly what it is. So if you want to watch the podcast rather than listening to the podcast, we are on the AV Forums YouTube channel. So it's the AV Forums podcast channel, not the AV Forums main channel. So I know that's a little bit confusing, but the podcast is on the AV Forums podcast channel. Go and subscribe to that channel. And lots of you have been doing that recently. Thank you very much for that. You'll get every episode in video form on YouTube. And of course, we're also available on Spotify and other audio providers for the audio only version. So you can hunt us out there as well and subscribe through those providers. And if you enjoy our podcast, if you like the content, if you think more people should be listening to what we are saying here, then please do feel free to share this on social platforms and other forums and so on. Just go out there, share the link. If you think what we're saying is in any way interesting, that would be appreciated. And of course, who are we? Well, AV Forums, we've been around 20 odd years now. We started in 2000, the editorial started in 2003, and I've been the editor of the site for the last 20 years. My name's Phil Hinton. So what do I do? Well, I do the TV reviews, I do the podcasts, I host most of the podcast and most of the video content. Also on the podcast today is Martin Dew. Martin, very briefly, tell us all about yourself.
I've been with AV Forums, so I've been about 18 months now, and I write reviews of AV equipment of all prices and categories, I think is fair to say. I also write for some print media, and previously my professional career involved being at Lucasfilm THX and NEC Digital Cinema in California.
Excellent. Thanks for that, Martin. Also joining us is Matt. Matt's our most recent member of the editorials team. Just tell us a little bit about yourself, Matt.
Similar to Martin there, also from stateside originally, been reviewing for 12, 18 months now, covering the home AV section. That's where the passion is. Used to get into all kinds of trouble in my teenagehood with car stereos and the like, and kind of evolved that into home.
Excellent. And our special guest coming back again this month is Neil Davidson. Neil, quickly tell us about yourself.
So I've been involved in high-end home cinema systems for almost 20 years, Phil. I think you may remember us doing ISF trainings and all of those types of things all of those years ago. I've been lucky enough to indulge in my passion for a long time and make a few quid along the way. So I guess it's not too bad a life, is it?
No, excellent. So we're going to lean on Neil's knowledge of the room in a little while. Before that, we've got current competitions. We'll quickly go through these. So you can win a set of KEF LXS2 LT wireless speakers. They're worth £899. That competition is open till Thursday, the 25th of April at 11:59. That is the only hardware competition we've got running at the moment, but it's a good one. So go over to avforums.com/competitions to enter that. And to be eligible, you need to be an AV Forums member over 18, and you need to be resident in the UK. So essentially anybody in the UK apart from me can enter that. And we also have some disc competitions. If you like physical media, you want to support physical media, we've got DVDs, Blu-rays, 4K discs, all available to patrons and standard AV Forums members. Again, that address is avforums.com/competitions. And some previous winners, RGB123, Nice, simple username there. Won a pair of brand new Q-Acoustics M40 speakers. These are fantastic little speakers. They were worth £749, courtesy of Peter Tyson. And Irritated Badger, he won a Valencia Tuscany LX Ultimate Luxury Onyx Cinema Seat. That's a mouthful. Worth £2,200. Well done to you. Some fantastic prizes there. And just quickly wrapping up on the housekeeping, new patrons, we got John Theobald, Yoz, and Callum Smith. Thank you guys for joining us, patrons. You guys support us on a regular basis. It really is appreciated. Thank you very much for that. And Matt Evans bought us a coffee. Thank you very much, Matt. That is appreciated. And all your support really is appreciated on the podcast here. And it helps us one day make a good one, hopefully, at some point. Right, so we also have the Q&A feedback from our last Home AV podcast, which was seems like it was a long, long time ago. On the 18th of March, is home theatre dead? Was the subject line. It was a little bit clickbaity, but I think we actually discussed the subject of the title. Normally you get a clickbait title and then it's not relevant to what the title was, the content normally. We did answer that question. No, it's not dead, so you don't need to panic. We had some feedback from THX 1138 UK. He basically says the rise of large and inexpensive flat panels has made the big home cinema screen experience far more accessible. That's absolutely right. We're going to get onto that in a little bit. I'm pretty sure of that. I mean, you can pick up a 98-inch TCL TV for, I think it's now, it was 1900 quid. I think it's now 1799. You can pick that up. Hasn't got many LEDs or anything fancy on that TV, but you get Dolby Vision, you get about 400 nits brightness, and you get 98 inches for 1799 quid. That's phenomenal. It also says that he doesn't see a big shift in attitude of people who've dedicated cinema rooms, either downsizing and so on. He thinks that's still the thriving area of the hobby. And I guess, again, I think that comes down to demographics maybe there, Neil. I think maybe certain people at certain points in the hobby maybe approach it in different ways.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, we're all at different stages in our lives. And we were discussing earlier, there's been some interesting debate around that. I think I'm probably more attuned to that since our discussion. You know, what is home theatre now? It's changed, you know. You don't need that big dedicated room to fit all of the gear in. You can put a nice big flat panel and a good sounding soundbar. And honestly, yeah, that's a very exciting and accessible media experience for a lot of us now. I certainly wouldn't be the one that looked down on that in any way. That's still a great experience.
Yeah. And go on.
Well, I was going to say, and that's really created an entryway, which I think brings a lot of people into this without even realizing that they've become into it. And of course, you know, it's still a relatively small percentage that go further with that whole thing. But yeah, we've all got to get hooked somehow, don't we?
Yeah, well, I mean, you're probably like me and probably like Martin as well. I don't want to speak for Matt, but I mean, for me, it was Nikon stereo into the back of the hi-fi, then a Laserdisc player, then a ProLogic amplifier. So yeah, it kind of builds and builds. And if there's an easy access point for people into the hobby and they get hooked, then yeah, that's a very interesting point of view that I hadn't actually thought about there, Neil. Thank you. Another thing that THX 1138 said was the entry price for good quality projectors has definitely increased. He seems to think that a few years ago, a JVC projector, a good quality one, would be about £4,000. You're now talking £6,000 entry point. Is it a case of inflation there rather than the manufacturer pushing the prices up? I think, you know, I can remember when JVC projectors were at that price point, but I think everything's kind of moved up a notch, hasn't it, Neil, in terms of costs and manufacturing. Again, JVC, not a volume industry there in terms of projectors. That's still quite a niche market.
Well, I don't know if I would necessarily agree with that statement either. So of course, there's always inflation. You know, it's a long time since a JVC projector was $4,995, which I can also remember. But also in those days, you know, it was 1080p and it was a lamp and it was a lot of things that are different. The software was nowhere as sophisticated as it needs to be now. But then also, what we might perhaps consider to be a good projector also changed a lot. You know, there are a lot of other companies out there now that produce very, very accessible, very good quality stuff. Epson, the fantastic products. A lot of Chinese brands, you see that now popping up, thanks to the ALPD tech, pops up all over the forums. You know, I have a little projector that I use for outside that was 800 quid, and honestly, it entertains me every single time I use it. Maybe not a reference in terms of image quality, but it doesn't make it any less enjoyable. Of course, at the high end, we still have, you know, 400 grand projectors if Sir wants to pay that sort of money. But that's a different thing altogether for a different application. So, yeah, pretty much like everything, I guess your Whisper also costs a lot more these days for a lot less. So who's to decide?
Yeah. I think also JVC moved away from that e-shift, that sort of hybrid technology, and obviously going to native panels is probably more of a...
Yeah, that did see a significant increase in price, obviously, if you're going to native panels. And Sony were already there, so they had to compete.
But as Neil says, you know, the Epsons are amazing price performance models. You know, the TW9400 and the LS12000, fantastic models. And also BenQ's 5700, I think it is. That's a very fine projector. So,
I looked at the, I think it was a W4000 I looked at BenQ last year. It comes calibrated out the factory. It comes with a document that shows you that they measured it and calibrated it as it was coming out the door. So, there's some really good projectors out there. And his last comment was, for true enthusiasts, he says, a projector cinematic experience wins every time. And it's something we've said, and I've certainly said it a number of times on the podcast, you can't beat a reflected projected image in terms of cinema. That is cinema. That's what we all know is cinema. So moving on from some of the Q&A's. So Toon Army says, thanks, gents, for an interesting listen. A key aspect, in his opinion, is the ability for potential customers to experience the equipment and setups in custom installations before they make an informed decision. Up until recent years, there's been a limited opportunity to see various setups at the Bristol show. However, that's more audio-focused nowadays. And even before then, there was the odd place where you could see an installer's setup, but it seems to be very limited these days. And he seems to be of the opinion that more people would like to see that. And of course, we've got Neil on the podcast. Neil, you deal to custom installers. How do people get to witness these systems in person and before they make their decisions?
Well, I think that's one of the things that's very interesting. Having previously owned my own very, very expensive showroom, it is a huge cost to maintain these things, and it's different from hi-fi, where you can have 10 pairs of speakers and you can rotate them and all the rest of the stuff. And a cinema, you're installing high-end gear and it's there. You're not going to swap it out without ripping the whole room apart. However, the good news is that there are places that people can experience this stuff. Distributors often throughout the UK, I can think of 5, 6, 7 very high-end cinemas that people can go to. But I think that one of the most interesting things now, and it's perhaps where Europe has lagged behind the US, is integrators now are really getting back to doing showrooms. In the US, it's amazing to me when I go over there. And remember, I've been doing this a long time, and I go into some of the showrooms purely for home cinema. If you want to look up Atlanta Home Theatre, for example, something like 13, 14 cinemas in that place. There's nothing like that in the UK, but there are more and more of them starting to be done, which are for normal consumers. I think also one of the things that's changed with respect to that, a lot of CI guys were really smart home and home cinema, and you're really starting to see a move now where people tend to specialize either in one or the other. Of course, they have to know a bit about both subjects. But if you're really setting yourself out as a cinema company, of course, you're anxious to put on a showroom that lets the client see what you can do for them. So there are more and more opportunities for people to see that stuff than, I think, honestly, ever there used to be.
I think on the forum side as well, the community is starting to open their doors more. So, like, I know I've been to 2 or 3 different community member cinemas, right, where they just said, hey, do you want to come over and watch a film kind of thing? And that's a much more informal, you know, but it still gives you that exposure to that degree of systems. Like, I think both owners had Trinoffs, for instance. So you get exposed to that higher end kit, and that's why they're opening their doors, right? So I think there's both angles. There's a lot more opportunity than I think what people have. You just got to ask the right question.
Yeah. And then the final Q&A was, it's more of an opinion as well, that they think, Captain Ron thinks that 4K UST projectors are starting to gain traction. They're seriously capable models, not mega bucks. And again, it's a solution that could work in various living room setups, media room setups. The only thing with that, and the only thing I would say, given the time that I've spent with these units, is you need a screen. Don't buy one of these UST projectors and just point it at a white wall. The first thing you'll notice is that your wall is not flat. As soon as you turn the projector on, you're going to notice all sorts of imperfections in your wall that you thought was really smooth. And again, you lose a lot of light, you lose a lot of contrast. Having an ambient light rejection screen of some description will get the very best out of these units. And some of them are really quite capable units and can be used in pretty high-end cinema rooms and media rooms. So yeah, that is one route. Just like I say, think about it. And an ALR screen is an absolute must for something like that. Right, so that's all the Q&As. Lots of those in, lots of them that we didn't get around to answering as well, because time is short on the podcast. But we'll try and reply to the threads or to the questions in person as well, so you get an answer, even if it's not read out on the podcast. Right, so let's move on to our subjects for today. And the first one I need to mention is an open house event, which is happening at Peter Tyson in Newcastle. They have a fantastic facility there. You walk into this and it's like a TARDIS. You think you're walking into a shop unit. You go up a staircase at the back of this shop unit, and they've got the whole first floor, four or five demo rooms, big speaker area, lots of systems on show, and they're opening the doors. It's a no pressure sales event. You can go along, just go for an hour, go for a couple of hours, take your own audio choices with you and ask to play around with the kit. So you'll find everything from the new Bowers & Wilkins 700S3 signatures, which have just been announced and just launched. There's also some 803s partnered with Marantz PM10s, SA10. There's also Name and Focal. You have lots of other brands like Name Statement, Macintosh, Sonus Faber, Linn, and lots of others, lots of expensive systems. So it's just what Neil was talking about earlier. It's your opportunity to go along and listen to things that you maybe think are out of your price range, or maybe are well out of your price range, but it gives you a reference point. It's something as enthusiasts we all like to do. We all like to listen to the latest and greatest. Kind of like car enthusiasts are always interested in what Ferrari and Aston Martin and everybody else are doing. Even if we'll never be able to afford something like that, you want to see what the top end of the market is. You want to see what good audio is, then head along to that. It's a free event. It's open door. You don't have to sign up or anything. That's on the 27th and 28th of April at their showroom in Newcastle. All the details are on the forums, so go and check that out. And it'll be on the homepage as of next week, so it should be nice and easy to find there. So that's what we needed to cover first of all. Right, the main subject. I'm going to come to Neil first. Neil, we've been banging on about this 20-odd years. I think one of the first discussions we ever had was all about the room. It wasn't about the kit. And, you know, we can talk about Trinoffs, as Matt's already mentioned. You can talk about £75,000 Linn monoblock amplifiers. You can talk about, you know, 400 grand's worth of projector. It's useless if the room doesn't give the best in terms of audio and visual experience. And in most cases, out of the box, they don't.
Yeah, well, as you say, we've been talking about it for a long time, Phil. So, you know, one of these days, I guess people will catch up to this subject. Now, I think there's actually three elements that we should consider when it comes to the room. The first one is obviously the audio, okay? You'll see all these statistics bandied around how the sound bounces off the room and all that type of stuff. What's clear is that the sound doesn't just come directly to your ears. The room plays a big part in that. Now, there's no room EQ that can correct for all of these anomalies that happen. They have to do less work, the better that your room is, in fact, is what always happens. So acoustically, that's the first thing you want to consider. The second thing that you will have to consider is related to video, and talk about reflection, contrast levels, all of that type of stuff. They're also very, very important points. But for me, one of the things that's become much more relevant for me in my professional life, and I think more and more for users, is the aesthetic of the room. Now, if you want the very best technical performance, of course, you will have that discussion about which velvet is the blackest velvet and how to minimize the seams and all the rest of it. And I appreciate people who go to that level, but simply not aesthetically pleasing, okay? Now, if you are ever lucky enough to go into a beautifully designed room with wonderful craftsmanship that just has light to die for, the minute of theater when you step into that space, honestly, is almost, in many cases, the best thing about the whole project. So if you can do that magical thing of combine not just the technical performance, but the aesthetic performance as well, that's when you elevate into something really, truly incredible. And I think that that's what the room does. And that aesthetic, that element of excitement, special space, that's a big part of that whole thing.
Now, of course, you know, the enthusiasts amongst us here, the first thing we're going to say is, oh no, white coloured walls, white coloured ceilings, handing the room over to the interior designer, what a mistake you've made there. But it's not really like that a lot these days, is it? I think even interior designers are now cutting on to the fact in this industry, Neil, that there has to be some give and take when it comes to the technical performance, but also the aesthetics and the interior design of the room.
Well, I think that professional people are more involved than ever before in these types of projects. And, you know, they're not idiots. People learn what works and what doesn't work. We've actually been lucky that always we've had a very good reception from interior designers and architects who are interested in actually delivering the best for their clients. Now, one of the things that you often find, though, is I'm sure many members of the forums will go online and they'll research cinemas and they'll find pictures on Google and they'll go, oh, that's dreadful. That client probably got what they wanted, though. Mm. Okay, that's what you've got to remember. Now, there does come a point where if that guy or gal wants a cinema that's a beautiful white room, technically, you're going to do your best to tell them not to. But if that's what they want, is it better to let them have that, or is it better to fight a fight and give them something that they don't like at the end of it? Okay. So that's where that point is very, very important about the aesthetics. For many people, that in fact can be just as important as the technical result in the room. Because if they hate the room, they ain't going to go into it anyway. It doesn't matter how technically performant it is. However, of course, you always want to try and do your best to help make sure the material choices and the fabrics and the colours, etc., are optimised as much as possible.
Yeah. So let's dial it back then. Let's, you know, put ourselves in the position of our listeners out there. There's various rooms that they may want to put their system into. It may be a living room. In most cases, it will be a living room. There's very few people out there, I think, have actual dedicated spaces that can be used as a home cinema. So from that point of view, Matt, let's take your living room, for example, or your theatre room. Tell us a little bit about that and some of the issues that you've had to overcome in terms of putting that room together and your system.
Oh, yeah. All of them is the answer. All the issues. I think my room is actually very badly acoustically designed. So going back to what Neil was saying, it's got hard tile floor. It's got three sets of French doors and a window. So I've got almost a panel of glass on every wall besides the wall that the television's on. I've got a pool table that sits behind me, so I can't do the two-thirds rule on the seating. So I'm actually in the front third of the room instead of the back, which means that my rear surrounds have to be set quite close, like quite high on the gain compared to the front soundstage. So it compromises all around on a lot of that stuff. I got really bad RT60 when I measure it. So clap echo for those that don't know that. So it, you know, and I try and treat some of these things But yeah, it was a compromised room to begin with. And I've just tried to, you know, add the carpet, add the treatment at the first reflections, do what I can, again, trade off with aesthetics. So the back end of the room is used for parties, pool and darts and that kind of thing, which was the trade off with the family that I had to make, right? Because it's not, so it's semi-dedicated in the sense that the front room is semi-dedicated and the back room is party. But yeah, it still works, still very enjoyable. You can still control the light. I've painted it gray now. It's a white ceiling, but gray walls. I got away with that, mostly because I said I'd do it. So yeah, I think back to the aesthetics thing though, I was recently lucky enough to go out to Disney. And one of the things you realize that makes Disney set apart from every other thrill roller coaster type park is the lead up to the ride. It's like a ride within itself, and that's all the aesthetic. So for instance, the Tron ride, which if you ever go to Disney and you're an adult, go on the Tron ride. It's amazing because you literally get bolted down in this motorcycle Tron light cycle thing, but it's the lead up to it. They play the movie soundtrack. It's all the Tron light cycle things and whatever in the full uniform. And it makes you feel like you are, you know, a digitized version of a Tron character. And that gets you, that makes the ride probably five times better than just if you jumped on the ride. So aesthetics to a room, I would say, do have a big part in that, especially for your non-technical viewers, right? Like your wife or your partner or your friend that maybe is your friend but isn't an enthusiast with you. They'll be more impressed with that side of it than they will if you got exactly the right nit output on your reference display.
You're lucky enough to have a little sweet shot. And your little foyer on the way into the cinema. I guarantee no one ever spoke about how good your cinema performance was. It was a guy it's had sweet. A sweet shop.
Yeah. Or the popcorn maker. Make an actual popcorn. But I think Neil, Matt's room's pretty typical of the vast majority of British homes. I know we've got a large US audience out there as well, and we'll come on to the differences in a little while. But you know, for a UK home, that's almost atypical in terms of the issues that you're going to have in a living room or in a kitchen, diner, or whatever room you're going to be left to use. So what kind of things can people think about in terms of making that space a little bit better acoustically? Because that's the thing that I'm going to notice the most. The hand clap, like Matt said, you know, it's a test that everybody does when you walk into a room, and sometimes you'll hear the echo before you even clap your hands. What are the things that people can be thinking about in terms of, you know, getting around some of these acoustical problems? And we're not talking about, you know, gluing some foam and shoving it on the walls. And it has to be a living space. It has to look nice. It has to be a usable room at the end of the day. We're not going to paint it black.
So, well, interestingly, there's a lot of the stuff that you can do without ending up with horrible aesthetic appearances. The first thing is it's all about balance, right? And I'm sure there'll be many people who are watching this right now who are well into it. They go, Lloyd Toole's book tells us that his living room is perfectly acoustic, right? The reason is that Lloyd Toole understands us better than anyone in the whole world, how to position that book for optimal effect and so on. Now, that's one of the things that's actually cool about most living room theatres. Guess what? You have a big couch in it. You have a carpet or a big rug, most of us, in our living room spaces. It's already going a long way to helping the acoustics. The next thing that you look at is you look at the walls. Do you have shelves? Do you have a bookcase? Do you have something like that that removes the flatness? Because that flatness is where you get your echoes. Something that breaks that up. If you have shelves with all these ornaments on it, believe it or not, that's a valid acoustic design. People at Hot Toys will be like adding that to their listings now. They'll be doing testing on all of their models and so on to show how much acoustic benefit they bring. These are all things that are really valid and actually make a big, big difference. Not just when you're watching a movie, but when you're actually sitting in the room with friends or with your wife or whatever else, just conversing. And that's actually one of the best tests that you can do. Never mind the movie. If you're sitting there, is the room comfortable to speak in? If it's like echoey, actually that makes it more difficult to understand what people are saying. One of the big problems with many cinemas is that they end up with too much absorption. They are over damped, and that actually robs a lot of efficiency out of the system and intelligibility, believe it or not, out of the system. It's actually quite easy to go way too far in that whole thing. So you don't want to necessarily do too much of that. Now, I think design tastes have changed. I mean, we heard from Matt about tile floor and all that. I recently did my house, and yep, it's all hard floors through there. And we have the rug. Now, believe it or not, a little bit of hard floor in a cinema is actually a wonderful thing because it helps to balance your acoustic on the vertical axis, which is normally the biggest challenge that you have when you cover the floor with carpet. That helps a little bit with the balance, though, in a media room when we do that. Now, I have pictures, quite big pictures on the wall and stuff like that, and that actually does give you a chance to add some absorption into the space without it necessarily looking weird, okay? That could be a print, it could be whatever else it is, and you can back behind that if you really need to add some extra absorption into it. But normally that's not such a big problem in a normal UK domestic situation. We've normally just about got it.
And Neil, there's some other trends that you see looking at Instagram and other places, and a lot of companies now getting into this marketplace where, like you said, absorption, a lot of them now doing really nice designed tiles that you can actually create some nice artwork on the wall, which actually does a job in terms of, you know, getting rid of some of the first reflection points and that kind of thing. And even wood slats are a big fashion thing at the minute. Everyone wants the wood slats on the wall, but they are actually very useful.
I'm smiling because 60 wood slats were affixed to my walls by my own fair hands this weekend. If I never smell Gripfill again, then that will be too soon. I don't mind telling you. The wood slats is a really interesting one. We've been lucky enough to be involved in some pretty amazing cinemas lately with that whole wood slat design. Now, there's two types of wood slat. The first one everyone will be familiar with. They're everywhere on Instagram and all over the internet and so on. And what they have is they have a PET felt backing, 12mm, 9mm, whichever one it is. And they have a fairly thin wood slat on the front of it, typically 9mm MDF with a front face veneer. Okay. Now, those are very easy to install, and they have a very nice mid-band acoustic benefit. They're a great choice for living rooms and all that type of stuff because they look great and they help with the sound without really going crazy in either direction. The only thing I personally struggle with them, and there'll be people screaming at the camera now, because they're MDF veneered on one face, you see the MDF inside it. If anyone wants to go away just now and look, you will see that you really see the MDF slats inside. For myself, I wanted to go a little bit beyond that. So I have a 30mm wide, 40mm deep batten, which is MDF, but it's veneered on all sides so that it looks better. But it also brings in my sunroom, like Matt said, with glass on all three sides, a much better acoustical benefit in terms of breaking up the sound, not absorptive, but much more diffusive of that sound field, simply because it's much deeper than your normal wood battens. But let me tell you, much more difficult to install.
Yeah, well, and there's a few things off that, because I know you mentioned Floyd Toole and stuff, and I think in his book he says if it's not 2 inches or more or something, don't put it in, mostly because it's too focused on a particular band. So I think I see this a lot too, where someone will go to Amazon or eBay or whatever, and they'll buy really, really thin stuff and they'll put it everywhere, and then they'll go, that's going to fix it. And it goes, well, yeah, that'll fix it for like the 5K up range or whatever. You know what I mean? It's not applying to the whole band like you think it is. And I think that's, you know, then you get into the measurement discussion and all the rest of it. But I'm kind of hopeful in my space that while it is overly echoey, I do think that I could probably just accept that it's going to be a more lively room. So instead of trying to deaden the whole thing, I could go down the more diffusive route and just dissipate the energy in a different way, still keep it light and airy and not so, like you said, homes like theater dead, where it's not, because it's still got to be a multi-purpose room. So diffusion would probably make more sense in that shared purpose space.
So I should stress that I have been involved in the acoustics business for quite some years, simply because of that exact problem. In years gone by, you couldn't buy a diffuser that was less than 200 mil deep. Okay. And that's based on the mathematical process of true diffusion. Okay. And that is real maths. Very fantastic work done by very, very clever people to work out those things. Guess what? I can't give that away. Because if I want to be involved in a house in London and I tell them that they've got to give up 400 millimeters of wall space, they say, that wall space costs £40,000, sir. You are crazy. So that is not really an option in a lot of projects. So we had to come up with a solution. Indeed, it's 50 mil or less deep. Now, you can do a lot of absorption in that space because there are tricks that you can do. The trick, and this is what misses in most theatres, is diffusion, is the scattering of the sound. Now, diffusion is a real thing, okay? And I always try to speak of diffusion in that mathematical sense, right? Where if you're really into that proper, yeah, you've got to accept that it's a deep product to deliver a truly diffuse sound field. But scattering the sound in a way that doesn't lobe is a different thing and is equally effective. And that's where your slats, that's where the products that we make, which are a more three-dimensional scattering, make an incredible difference to the room. And when you hear a room that's had that done well to it, because you get rid of the echo, but you keep the impact, that's when you move into a different planet of these things.
Bookshelves in the living room can help in that respect as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So, with the toys on them, remember.
Yeah.
So the acoustics, it's one of these deep dive subjects, and it's one that we're probably going to come back to on future podcasts as the year goes on. But you know, there are things that you can do. Neil's explained some of the things that you can do that's quite simple in terms of a UK living room, which is, you know, atypical. They usually are round about the same size, usually around about the same shape as well. Now let's move on very briefly to talk about US and other territories out there, because a lot of people around the world listen in. We're talking about bigger spaces, but we're also talking about rooms that have been built differently to most UK rooms. Most UK are brick and plaster and so on. US in particular have many different types of building techniques, Neil, and that can add to the issues.
So there's actually two parts to that as well. So one is sound isolation, which we should always consider separate to acoustic treatment. And all of us have our own thoughts on what sound isolation is. Very, very lucky to be working in an amazing house in Edinburgh over the last few years. That's a big townhouse in Edinburgh, and that has a cinema that will top 120 decibels. I don't think his neighbours will be very happy if they were to be disturbed by his cinema. I was amazed, even for me, how good the sound isolation is in that room, because you can just go out the single leaf door and you barely hear that cinema when it's in full action. So that was sound isolation. Now, we have the advantage of brick in a lot of our construction, which helps with sound isolation. Mass is a big part of that. However, the rigidity of that can lead to other issues, which is that the sound travels through the structure. Structural-borne sound contamination is a huge thing. You've actually got to isolate that sound energy from getting into the structure as well. Now, a lot of Europe, they use a poured concrete construction, which is actually even more massive in many ways than what we will have with our block construction here in the UK. That structural noise is a big issue in those types of construction. And in the US, of course, it's much, much more common to find timber frame construction. Now, timber frame construction acoustically is very interesting because there are perhaps more opportunities to break that structural connection that, that lets the noise transfer through. But the actual build of the room has a very important acoustic benefit as well. And I know that this will lead hopefully into another part of the discussion that we're going to have. Plasterboard walls are a very important part of your base absorption technique. Okay. That big wall, even though it looks super rigid when you're standing next to it, that flexes when the base energy hits it. And if you're talking systems with lots of subwoofers, it's a lot of energy goes out into the space. Well, what you want to do is you want to absorb that energy and convert that into something that isn't noise. That's typically what acoustics is all about. Just convert it into something not bad. So if that wall's moving, you take the sound energy, you move that into kinetic energy, moving energy, and then that dissipates as heat. Well, you don't hear those things. So that helps you with your standing waves, which are the biggest problem that you have with bass. So in fact, one of the things that you often find is rooms that are built too massive, they're too rigid, often have bass problems because there's no flex in them. So the whole actual construction is this weird, you want a massive construction for sound isolation purposes, but you want it to be flexible for acoustic treatment purposes. So it's an interesting balance that you have to come across. And there the American construction tends to be a little bit more forgiving, in fact, than we have over here.
So you hear people use the term wall within a wall. So are you saying that the exterior wall would be the one that you'd want to have rigid mass, and then the interior wall you'd want more flexible? Would that solve?
So yeah, that's a typical way that you do it. So a room within a room type situation. That's typically the benefit that you get from the internal room of building that in a way that it has some measure flex to. It also helps the sound going through it, of course, but it helps with all of these other things as well.
Excellent. Right. So let's leave acoustics. Let's park that for the time being. I think we've covered most of what we need to cover just in a general discussion about the room. The room is your enemy. We're trying to make the room a little bit more user-friendly. So let's move from audio to visual. And this is where aesthetics can be an issue, Neil, because at the end of the day, our films are graded in a grading suite. I think the SMT say that the bias lighting needs to be 0.5 nits, which shows you how dark a grading room is if the bias light to help the grader's eye is as low as that. It's almost black. This is the issue when it comes to video. If and certainly projection, if you want to get the absolute best, you need to be living in a grading suite. None of us live in a grading suite. So how do we approach this problem? What are the tips and tricks that we can use to, you know, make our viewing not reference, but as close to reference as possible?
So I'll say my ideas here, guys, and I hope that you will have some comments to add on to my thoughts, right? I don't actually enjoy watching in a completely black room. Okay, I find it strains my eyes quite often. And in particular, now that we've got HDR and even with projection systems, you know, we're striving for a lot more brightness. I tend to find, definitely with a flat panel, but even now in a lot of the cinemas, a low level amount of brightness to stop my eye closing all the way down personally helps me, because I don't get eye strain or anything like that through it. Of course, that also then has a knock-on benefit in my perceived contrast and so on. Now, the trade-off in my personal preference of viewing is that puts a little bit more emphasis on the wall color, because of course, if it was a light color, it would light up much more dramatically. My own living room is a very, very dark blue colour. I don't always choose this, but it just seems to be the colour always associated with me. So my living room indeed is a very, very dark blue colour like that. Now, for the calibrators and the colour scientists out there, there's a chemical response in your eye that when the light level drops below a certain point, you stop perceiving colour. And that dark blue, dark reds, all that type of stuff, it actually starts to look black or dark grey once you get the light low enough. You've got to watch for reflected tints of that. But that's a very nice trick that you can use to prevent the image from being, what's the word I'm looking for, being compromised by reflected light that's falling onto the screen. The other big one, of course, is the choice of materials. Most theatres, of course, we're a bit luckier because we're going to do fabric walls or something like that in the theatre. You do see a lot more of that stuff in living spaces now, I have to say. It's also become very popular because people do appreciate the acoustic benefit when you've got hard floors and so on. You can move that up onto the wall. But again, my own living room is painted. It's not, you know, I haven't done anything to try and prevent that, but it's a matte paint that's used within that image area so that we're not getting reflections and stuff like that of things. I don't have glass on those pictures that I mentioned earlier on so that we're not reflecting off of those surfaces. So just a few little things, but not black. That's really the key thing for me. I mean, black in the darkness sense of it as opposed to the color sense of it.
Yeah, so, I mean, I guess that there are two routes that we've taken here. So projection-wise or flat panel-wise, there are differences. The different technologies you can get away with different techniques. Let's go to Martin. Martin, what do you use in your space? And tell us a little bit about your space, because it is unique in terms of it's a rented space, but you wanted to do particular things, so you've gone about it in a different way.
Yeah, it's a rented space, and having owned for many years until this point, I don't know how temporary or permanent this situation is going to be, but part of the reason I rented this flat, it's in a town centre. The flat is on two levels. It's a Georgian building, but specced out to, I guess, to a high degree inside in terms of the technology inside the unit. But walking in on the first occasion, I turned right at the bottom of the stairs in the basement, and there was a spare space, which would be ideal for a home cinema, and recessed lighting all on dimmers. And just seemed like it would be perfect. I mean, actually, even in terms of isolation, because this part of the building is Georgian, the walls are 18 inches thick. And also has been sound isolated to a very high degree. And actually, the construction company I spoke to when I moved in, they said they said it is the best sound isolated building in my town. So that was very nice to hear. But yeah, I mean, I knew that area was going to present challenges. Being a rented flat, obviously, I could not put a permanent fitted carpet down. But the landlady did agree to me putting a rug down. And so I had a rug fitted by a carpet company. So it looks like a fitted carpet. And it's perfect for running cables under because you can easily hide them. Also, of course, I would not be able to hang Dolby Atmos speakers from the ceiling. So I got a very experienced carpenter / craftsman in Henley, told him what my problem was. Henley's the town I live in. And he said, well, I can solve that for you. He said, I can build you a truss from which to hang your Dolby Atmos speakers. And of course, then that cage then also serves as somewhere upon which to hang the projector and also the screen. And because he's built it in such a way that geometrically it's absolutely perfect, it means that mounting the projector also means that the screen is absolutely dead on as well. But yeah, it seemed to solve a lot of problems. And then also that frame then also became the ability by which I could also hang black material behind the screen and built a light reflection absorber with styrofoam and black velvet across the top as well. And now my plan is to build some blackout actually around to the sides as well. Then playing into all that, I've got the acoustical challenges. Of course, it's open backed, which means, yes, I do get long decay times, apparently going back into the room. But Lingdorf's Room Perfect helps an awful lot to keep the sound centered into the seating area. It's funny, you even walk a few steps back from the back of the viewing area and the energy of the sound just dissipates. And I think that's partly because of the efficacy of Lingdorf's Room Perfect. But I'm very happy with the sound I've got in there. Yes, of course, it could be improved. I can't do any acoustical panels, but I've got lots of soft furnishings in there. And I seem to get a nice sort of balance of absorption and diffusion, which I think is sort of hopefully the game.
Yeah, and it's a unique approach. You know, rented property does throw up some challenges. You can't put things on the wall and so on. Well, you're not supposed to anyway. So it's a neat solution that you've got there. And obviously using it as a professional workspace as well. I'm looking forward to seeing the photos.
Totally. And you know, it's best to have a good relationship with your landlord or landlady as well. And I think it's very good to be on sort of, open terms. I mean, you're effectively the caretaker of their property. Why not keep the dialogue lines open? And absolutely. In my particular case, my landlady seems very receptive and knows what I'm doing. So, you know.
Yeah, cool. Good stuff. So I guess in terms of vision, we can't go black. I think suggesting anything other than a dedicated room that you did something like that, people are just going to say, don't be silly and walk away, Neil, because like you say, at the end of the day, some of these rooms are more media rooms than theatre rooms, and they have to serve different purposes and so on. And I've got this interesting little thing on the go at the minute because I've just moved house. I've just moved into a new build now for many years, and you came round my place quite a number of times, Neil, over the years in terms of, it was a room that we both knew very, very well. We'd measured it out. We'd done all the, you know, we knew where the room modes were. We knew exactly where to place speakers. And for me as a reviewer, that was great because it just meant swapping things out and I didn't have to do a lot of remeasurement and so on. I knew how the room was going to behave. I knew as the speakers were coming into the room, how they were going to work within that space. And it's great when you get to know your room like that. I've now got this, I now feel like I'm kind of lost a little bit because I'm now out of my comfort zone. I no longer have that room. I no longer have a dedicated theatre room, and I'm not going to have one in this new space. And obviously what I do for a living is testing TVs, testing projectors, testing speakers. So I do have a garage that's built into the house with a door that's already exists from the house into the garage. And it's 16 foot by 8 foot. And this room has to perform a number of roles. And we've already had initial discussions on this one, Neil, because I think it's a good little use case, and we're going to document it for forum members, and we're going to show people how we go about solving some of the problems with this room, because it's unique, but it's not unique because there's lots of people out there who will either move into a new build or move into a property that has a garage, and it's an ideal space to have a theatre room, to have a media room, or in my case, have a workspace. So what issues are you expecting us to find with that kind of space? Maybe approach this in three different ways. So obviously there's my workspace and the way that it's going to have to be a YouTube studio. So we're going to have to get the lighting right in there. We're going to have to get materials. It's going to have to be sound damped. So, you know, you won't get any echo when you're talking to camera and that kind of thing. It needs to be for TV testing. So it needs to be like a normal living room. But at the same time, I need to have complete and utter blackout so I can do proper measurements and so on and shoot video without reflections on the screen. And then it has to be used for testing sound as well. You know, we're going to get speakers in and test them and that kind of thing. So let's take that use case first of all. What kind of things are we looking at? What kind of challenges are we looking at in that room?
So broad spectrum of question there. I think, well, one, it's interesting because let's face it, that's the most common spare room that most of us have got in our homes, isn't it? Is that garage, it's just sitting there ripe for conversion into something more useful than putting garden tools into. So I think, one, it's a very interesting experiment for everybody. Now, the second thing that we already discussed is for you as a studio, that's probably not a necessarily typical situation compared to most people. Actually, Martin's frame is very, very interesting. We've already spoken about multiple camera rigs and all that type of stuff. you'll have the advantage perhaps that you can do something a little bit more permanent. But that trust, for want of a better term of describing it, is actually a very flexible thing in a space like what you are looking to do, because it allows you to position a lot of things to be very efficient in your working life. I don't know if too many viewers of this will be thinking, yes, trust, that's the thing that I'm missing in my life. Hey, if you can get it past the wife, then it's a very, very efficient way of putting stuff onto walls and ceilings, I don't mind telling you. The next thing that we probably do want to discuss as well is in terms of the acoustics. And actually, Matt touched on this already. It would be easy to fall into the trap of eating up that valuable floor space by trying to do lots of complicated acoustical treatment. That shouldn't be a goal in that space. You just don't have a foot or 2 feet to lose off the width of that room. That would be crazy to do something like that. A mild acoustic treatment with some stretch fabric is going to do an amazing job of balancing the acoustics in that room for the multiple uses which you are doing. You've got to think that you'll be doing pieces to camera, therefore speech intelligibility and all of that type of stuff is equally as important as envelopment in the surround sense and so on. Now, our fabric gives us another advantage, which is typically it will not be reflective. Therefore, that will help you very much with video reviews, where instead of having to worry perhaps about paint reflections or anything interfering with what you're doing, you'll be able to avoid that. Now, one of the subjects, and I guess this is something that a lot of people doing a garage conversion will be considering, is do you block up the whole door or do you put a window in? Well, of course, that's always going to be dependent on personal circumstances and so on. But to me, it seems an awful shame to build a box room. You know, we've spent all our time trying to get rid of box rooms in our homes. That window and letting natural light in when you're working is a very, very important thing. Scientifically, we could drift off into lighting discussions and so on at this minute in time. But we don't want to miss out on that. Therefore, there is going to have to be that discussion about the use of blinds in that space to block out the light, but then also as an acoustic product relative to the glass in the window. Now, that's also, I'm sure people will not be surprised to find, a very interesting subject in acoustics, because guess what? You've got big glass buildings and all that type of stuff that need to be acoustically treated. Now, you can actually do a sound isolated roller blind. That's a real thing that can be done. Needs a very powerful motor because they've got to be heavy, these things. But because they're heavy and they're a limp mass, that limp mass is good from an acoustic bass point of view. Perhaps what you prefer to do is something like what I actually have, which is the blinds that are, I can't even remember the word for it now, like a pleated blind. And that space, the air gap that gets created when those blinds drop down, it's good from a thermal perspective, but it's also good acoustically at protecting sound from being reflected off the windows. It's actually quite an efficient way of doing an acoustic treatment in a very harsh glass environment that's so common for us. Rather than doing a roller blind, you do these blinds that are pleated like that. So these are some of the things that we're going to have to consider, just a little bit of modeling around your use case, which is a little bit unique, but then the typical problems that you find when you do a garage conversion and you want to make it useful. Now, we also just briefly touched on light there. One of the things that you often find with a garage conversion, even more so a north-facing garage conversion, is that they can be very dark, because you have that window right at one end normally. And normally what you're trying to do is at the other end of the room or you end up with a TV like facing that window at the back there. So light is actually quite important in that whole thing. Again, it's something that's integrated into my house. We have the lights on most of the time on that north facing side, low level and all the rest of it, but it balances the movement, if you like, through the space. It keeps a consistency of light level that's quite important to make the room feel a bit more natural as you're moving around in it.
Yeah. So those are all that whole thing's going to be properly documented, and we'll go through it and we'll discuss some of the items that we do find. And of course, there is a unique use case here that's going to be a workspace. But Neil, people will be turning these into home cinemas or media rooms. So what are the differences there in terms of what I'm proposing to do? Where can they get the best practice in terms of using a space like that? Like you say, you always want light coming in. I think I don't know what the other guys think, but I'm definitely putting a window in with it being a workspace and so on. But even if it was a theatre room, Matt, would you put the window in for when it's not being used as a theatre, or would you block the whole thing out?
It's funny you say this, because I'm actually looking at my garage, which is detached from the house, and it's like a prime thing. And I've already had the discussion with the wife about, she wants me out of that shared space. And I said, well, how about that garage? And she said, well, build me a spot where you can take all the stuff from the garage and put it in there, and then you can have the garage. So I think I'm going to be adamantly following your thread here.
My solution's a shed in the back garden. That's where all the packaging's going from the kit.
I'm already sitting in the shed in the back garden.
But I think for a workspace, yeah, Phil, for what you're doing, because I'm having the same debate about, you know, I'm probably going to have to put a bit of a room within a room for the rack, so I can put my rack out, so that all the noise isolation's beyond that. I was also contemplating putting a desk in there so that I could work from there for focused times, short bursts, you know, like 2 to 4 hours at a time. I'd go in there, crank out some work, and then, you know, go to somewhere with light. So I think your light consideration for your particular thing is very valid. I find in my shared space, I typically watch television at night, so my habits are more night-based. So I end up pulling all the blinds and stuff anyway. Now, granted, like I said, I've got 3 sets of doors and a window. That one window that is near the first reflection point, as is one of the set of doors. Well, the one set of doors, I've got an actual panel. That's like a standalone panel that I can move around. But the other one's the honeycomb or whatever, I think it was the term you were describing about those shades. And that goes down, and I leave that down 24/7. That never gets raised. So I think it depends on your habits and your intention for the room, which I think is something that is a word we don't often use enough, which goes back to aesthetics and all the rest of it, is what is your intention for the room? Because I think you're spot on, Neil, with what you said, is a lot of times we go and look at somebody else's room and go, well, that doesn't work. And it's like, yeah, but what was their intention? Because it's just like a product that we review. If you understand the intention, a lot of times it makes clear the design choices as you go. So Phil, I think for your thing, yeah, I'd definitely say a window, because you can always still control the light via another mean, but to not have the light to control in the first place, yeah, I think you'd probably regret.
So in your case, I assume that you're just going to brick it up then, Matt. Is that what you're suggesting?
Mine's already bricked up. There are no windows in my garage. So
okay,
I just need to worry about my leaky garage door. So if anybody's that limp mass that you were talking about, seems like something I need to. I don't know that I want to Google limp mass, though. I might need a safe search filter.
You've got to be very careful. Saying. Very yeah. careful.
Yeah. So I guess what we're saying is we don't need a black hole for rooms. It's all down to use case. Decide what you're going to do in your room if you're not already in the room that you're going to use. Think about how you're going to use that space. Think about the potential problems that you may have. Seek out help. There's lots of help on the forums. You've got a whole DIY and professional section in terms of building rooms, building cinemas and all that kind of thing. Of course, on the podcast here, on the Home AV podcast, we've got the likes of Neil. We're going to have other experts on. They'll give you all their knowledge, all their expertise. They'll answer your questions. And like I say, we're going to be putting together my sort of home working space, workroom, but there'll be lots of things within that that are going to be incredibly pertinent to what you may be doing in your workspace. Matt's going to be continuing the negotiations and hopefully starting his build soon, so we'll definitely cover that as well. And of course, we'll have a look at what Martin's done in his solution in terms of how he's gotten around the issue of rented accommodation, and lots of us live in rented accommodation as well, so that's going to be useful to you. Any final thoughts on this one before we go quickly to waveforming, Neil, in terms of, you know, walking into the room or the room that's already being used? How can we get people thinking a little bit more about that and how they improve it?
Well, I think a lot of what you've said, it's actually kind of common sense, right? And that often sounds like insulting when you say that to people. But if you look at your space, you know, if you put a light, for example, and you point that in the direction of the TV, that's obviously going to be negative. If you put a glass panel behind your head, that's very reflective. These are fairly easy things to avoid for people when they sit down. And I think that, Matt, you were dead on there. You know, you've got to think about what's the usage of that space. I have to be honest, I was extremely fortunate when I did my build recently because I had people in my own team who could completely render my entire house for me, and we could model every bit of it in 3D. It seemed excessive at the time, but I don't think you can imagine how much effort that saved in actually trying to work out what was going to work, what wouldn't work in colour and in space planning as well. So just that bit of time beforehand. I know it's all exciting on Easter to go and get the Dulux and slash it all over the place and all that type of stuff, but that little bit of time just thinking about, yeah, the application of the space and where the elements that you likely own, because you'll be reusing a lot of the stuff, are going to fit within that to have minimum negative or possibly positive effects. That's the best thing to do.
Right. Now, the other solution is go buy a shit ton of subwoofers, shove them in your room. And this seems to be the approach that we're going to talk about next, although it's a lot more scientific than that. They've actually cut down the number of subs that you actually need. So what are we talking about? We're talking about waveforming. So Neil and Matt are our two on the podcast who have witnessed this. Neil's had a lot of dealings with it. Matt's had the demos. What is waveforming? Tell me all about it. Pretend I don't know anything.
Matt, you got the sales speech. Over to you.
All right. I'll give my enthusiast reflection on it. So in its simplest form, and as Phil said, it is a shit ton of subwoofers, at least in the room I was in. I think they had 10. But essentially, you've got a front group. I got to be careful when I use the word array, because that gives off a different connotation for subwoofers. But you've got a grouping of subwoofers in the front, and they emit bass. And then you've got a grouping of subwoofers in the back, and they absorb the bass. And so one, you got to have a lot of wall space. But what they then try and do is the positioning, which there is, it goes kind of against the standards of what we have today, in the sense of you put them on the floor and you might corner load them or whatever, because of the waveforming is trying to literally form the wave. It's kind of in the name, but as we've been talking about, the room has all the bad properties to it, right? We normally see the room as an enemy. And so in the speech, what they gave is they said, well, what we're trying to do is just stop it from hitting the walls in the first place. So you give off this, I think they called it a planar wave, in the one form. And so that's what that front wall of subwoofers essentially emits. And what they do is they steer that so that it reduces or eliminates the reflections from the wall. And that essentially eliminates the room mode, because you can't get a room mode. Because that was my biggest question is, well, how does the room mode play into effect? And they said, well, you remove it because you're not reflecting it. So you're essentially removing, it never hits the wall to create the mode. So it forms that, there's a bunch of different terms that can be used. And then that goes if you see their demo clips or videos or whatever that the marketing teams come up with, it steers it quite perfectly to the back, and then it hits the back and that back wall, and you can see the subs move in the back and they dissipate, like we were talking about the room within a room. So essentially your subwoofers are that room within a room, is the simpler way I can explain it. And there's a lot of, like you said, there's a lot of math there. But that's the gist of it, is you've got a bunch of cleverly placed subs that are very capable in the front, and they are the emitters. And then in the back, you've got the same set, ideally in the back, in the same positions, and they absorb it. I don't know if you want me to stop there, Phil, or keep going. I got a whole load of things that I took notes on.
Well, maybe that's an interesting point to stop at. So, Neil, what are they trying to do with this? And is this the only solution to the problem, or is this just one solution to it?
So yeah, look, your typical problem that you've got with bass is that the wavelength of a bass sound is much, much longer than the room that you are in. So typically what will happen is that wave will travel from the speaker, the source, down the room, hit the wall on the opposite side and bounce back. Now, at certain frequencies, that wave is a proportion, exact dimension of the room. That's what standing waves are when they get reflected back. Okay. Now, what that does is that causes peaks or dips at known locations within the room at certain frequencies, all based on the room dimensions. Okay. Now, what waveforming is, it's a very clever way of doing a form of active acoustic treatment, where it uses the subs at the front and at the back. The movement of that sub is effectively an active sound absorber as well as an emitter. That's kind of the clever part about the whole thing. Now, is that the only approach? I have to be very careful because we're all friends with those guys and all that type of stuff. So, of course, that's not the only approach. I mean, we've been doing multiple subwoofer systems for many years, and I have to tell you, the fundamental underlying physics of those things did not change because a new and super cool technology came to the marketplace. I was in a room with four subwoofers just the other day, which was designed on particular principles that we've been using for many years. And guess what? It still worked absolutely flawlessly as expected because the physics didn't change. However, it did require a fair bit of modeling up front to make sure it would do as expected. And I think for me, that's the thing, that waveforming does also require some modeling, but it's also an opportunity to sell quite a lot of subwoofers.
Mm-hmm.
If you can do it, why not? It's cool. Why wouldn't you do it? And I think that there is a lot of that with that technology. So why not? It is also true that they are adding more and more technology into that as they sort of mature that system. Not the only way of getting good bass in a room at any place. Very cool, and definitely benefits you if you're in the fortunate position that you can have as many subs as you want. That's for sure.
Yeah, at least in today's state, because they did say in the demo that obviously Chernoff has got a customer base. So if you think about their products, they've got the Altitude 32 and the Altitude 16, right? So they're naturally going to start with their customers that have the high channel count, large installation like that Pulse Cinema room that I was in. So they're going to start with that. And they were talking about the planar wave, and that requires a certain amount of subwoofers. I think it's, I don't know if six was the minimum or 10 or whatever it was. It was a large number, larger than what you would typically fit in like a room like mine. Like, I've just put four in. I don't know how I got the agreement to get four in. I got lucky is all I can say. But for the Altitude 16 users that were there, I think they were thinking like, well, does that mean I got to go double my sub count? And the answer is, well, if you want to do the planar wave, yes, but there's a conical version that's supposed to be coming out that is much more wallet friendly, let's put it that way. So you can do it with four essentially, and obviously the benefits won't be as great because there's a whole height positioning thing and all the rest of it. Like you said, I think it's quite a complex answer. The thing that I found really impressive about it though was, they did a demo 50 hertz, which was a natural null in the room, and so they made you walk around so they just put a sine wave on 50 hertz and you're walking around the room and you can hear it instantly, right? Which is eye-opening for some people who have never done null tests like that. But then when they turned it on,
one of the coolest demos in cinema incidentally is a demo like that.
Yeah, so then they, you know, and then they flicked it on and they said, right, now go walk around the room again. And it was amazing, actually, the difference. So if there was a 6 to 10 dB swing, right, twice as loud, three times as loud swing in a null, and then you walk to that same null, there maybe was a 1 to 3 decibel swing, right? It did fill it in, so to speak, which is quite amazing from an acoustical perspective. The other thing that I thought was interesting that actually got downplayed a lot was their ability to control the decay. So, which I found interesting, and I don't know how, Neil, you have to correct me if I'm getting this wrong, but if you're not exciting the room and you know, because you're not hitting the wall and your speakers are doing all the emitting and absorbing, that means you can also control how much of that they're doing. So they, and again, I'm going to use terms that probably aren't the right adjectives, but it was essentially like the difference between dry or tight bass compared to wet or sloppy bass. And you could, it was like a dial, like a slider. And I actually asked the guy, I said, well, where in this dial did you put it for this demo? And he said, oh, I put it smack bang in the middle. I was like, oh, okay. So I thought that that was interesting. It gives you a slightly different level of control because it's active, like you said, whereas room treatment is passive. I think it's a little more forgiving or a little bit more configurable. So maybe for the tweakers out there,
yeah, interesting. So all of the things, and you precisely hit it there, Matt, all of the things in terms of EQ are all possible to do with a typical, you can get most of the way with two subs, right? If you're prepared to model the room. Four subs will get you really, really a lot of the way. We typically don't need to go more than that from an acoustical perspective. That element of wetness, dryness in the bass, that's where you move to the benefits of doing it in the active domain. And there's lots of different ways that you can do that. Okay, if you know the impulse response of the speaker in the room, there's pre-correction that you can do on the impulse response. That's basically what all room correction systems are doing, and there's been a million and one super cool correction techniques and pre-ringing and post-ringing and a million and one different things that you want to say that people have done. The thing that you've got is control. And I think that's, if you look at what Trinov have got, the power and the literal CPU processing power of their platform is the thing that sets that solution apart. Because when they get cool ideas, and I'm lucky enough to have known Arnaud Labarre for quite a number of years as well, very, 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 very clever man. When he gets an idea, he has the CPU processing power to implement that in a way probably that no one else is able to do. So that whole idea of wet, dry, that's about controlling the movement, the start, stopness of the bass. Now you can imagine, how do you do that on a driver? Well, you have to know, like, how much did that wobble about, basically?
Yeah, the excursion limits of the driver itself. Yeah.
But when you put that impulse into it, did it go and come back, or did it go? And you can do a lot if you know that to correct for that. That's what calibration is. It's correcting for these anomalies. And that's the real power of that whole thing, is that you can tune in how much stopping you want. Now, that's one thing. Here I'll make a gross generalization. Our American friends with their giant theaters and 200 subs that they're already used to, you tend to find American cinemas have got the most overblown wobbly bass ever. Gross generalization, I know, but that's my experience of quite a few of them. They love it. Why not? Okay. We are much, much more used over here to that tight bass, and maybe it's because we just got little subs and all the rest of it. They're tight, you know, they've got that good stoppability. That's really one of the balancing points I think that technology can do, is that it lets you really dial to taste between those two elements.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that's also, you know, you talk about starting with the building blocks and how it might compare to other technologies and things. And with all room correction software, as with most things in life, you got to have good inputs to expect a good output. And this is where I see, like, you look at the Trinov microphone and the expense of that microphone and the sophistication of that microphone. That is the most sophisticated microphone I've ever seen, right? Now, I'm not saying that Dirac can't do it or Lindoff, you know what I mean? Like all these other companies that have room correction software. But when you look at, okay, if you've got that thing that can gather resolution data at an extreme resolution, and then you also got the thing that can locally compute it, you're in a very good spot to do something that is probably more clever than someone else. So I think they've got the right building blocks to pull it off, I guess. regardless of whatever form it's in, as far as alpha, beta, you know, ready to release, that type of thing, you can debate that all day. It's more, I think they've got the right building blocks. Like you said, they've got the processing power locally, because everybody's got the processing power in the cloud if you want to send it up, right? So that's a moot point. If you got it locally, it reminds me of Tesla, really, in that sense. Like, they've got hardware, they got supercomputers in their car that allows it to self-drive. Now, can other cars self-drive?
Yes. That make the windscreen wipers work, though.
No, it's shitty. I know, I got one, and it's super bad. That's the number one annoyance with me. But it's funny that you notice that, too. It's a common Tesla thing that window wiper sensors suck. Yeah. Elon Musk needs to sort that. But the drive, I mean, they've actually got so much power in those cars that they've got two computers that run. One runs real, and the other one runs in simulation, so that they can train their neural net, and then it just swaps over. So they've got a true, like, that's how much processing power they've got in that car. I turn off is very similar in this sense, where they've got all that local processing power and they've got really good inputs, because let's face it, if you hooked up like, say, a standard Odyssey mic, you know, the little one that comes in the box, and you tried to do measurements for waveforming and you fed it to the Trinoff, you would not get good results, because the accuracy that it could measure that XMAX of that driver would not be very good. So that's where I think some of the stuff, like you said, it's all building off fundamental principles, and now they're getting to that higher level of sophistication with the room correction.
Sorry, I just moving around here, because I also wanted to show, because Matt called out something very interesting there. Let me show you what I use these days when I'm measuring.
He's going to put out an Odyssey mic now just to make me.
No, I don't have the money for that.
This will be something special, no, Neil.
That is a mini DSP UMic X. Okay. So that actually has four measurement points on it. And what you do is you daisy chain those together. So in the old days, we used to have to carry around like 20 condenser mics if we were going to do spatial measurements and stuff like that. Now you can have 16 of these bad boys connected together off one little interface that size. Now, for anyone not familiar with the Trinoff mic, because that's what we're talking about, a Trinoff mic has three measurement points, and I don't have one in here, unfortunately. It's in my car, in my Tesla, so no chance in the rain outside today. The thing of the Trinoff microphone is, when you align that, it has a directional awareness that no other measurement system has, because it can use the time difference between the sounds arriving at those different microphones to work out both azimuth and rotation of that speaker. So therefore, it can work out where in space it is. I can't do that with my little UMic X mic, but for enthusiasts who are using the Room EQ Wizard and stuff like that, that's 700 quid that's worth spending, I don't mind telling you, one of those measurement systems, because it really transformed for me my whole measurement game, much, much, much more efficient than it ever used to be, because you can get so much data, 16 measurements with one click. Yes, that changes the game completely.
Okay. We're going to have to wrap this up, because we've gone down the rabbit hole that I knew we were going to end up going down. The one question I forgot to ask, we've been talking about how it works and you know, the principle and all the rest of it. Matt, what did it sound like?
Mixed reviews. They played a Dolby Atmos song by Tiesto. I think it was called Boom. So if anybody wants to go look that up, I think you got to get it from Apple Music or whatever. That was a very impressive demo for that. What did it sound like beyond that? It sounded more even. It did what it said on the tin to a degree. There were certain people that said that it made them feel uncomfortable, which I thought was interesting. So I don't know if that's because of the way that it is changing the way, like the natural wave form. And maybe that's something that, you know, we don't talk about enough, is like when you get down into bass, you can't hear, but you can feel, you know, is it good for you? There's a debate on that in I think it's in the other forum, right? Like you said, big Americans, they always like the subterranean stuff. But as far as waveforming goes, does it work? I think if you've got issues with room modes and decay, I think it's a good tool in the tool belt. Do I think that the technology needs to develop so that it's more accessible to most of our viewers or listeners? Yes, I do. I think for some of Neil's clientele, probably they're probably jumping on it. And there's some very good use cases, multi-row, huge channel count. That's who it's ready for now. For the common guy like me, four subs in a compromised room who, you know, I'd have to scrape together and sell a car to get a turn off. Yeah, I'd probably have to wait a little bit for that to develop.
Well, as always, we get the trickle down, don't we? You know, it's the same with everything. But yeah, we need to wrap up at this point. So if you've got any questions about what we've covered today, if you've got a room you want some advice on, and the shape of your room, first reflection points, all that kind of thing, anything that we've discussed today, then get them in. You can do it the old-fashioned way on email, which is podcast@avforums.com. Or if you're watching us on YouTube, then go down into the comments section below and ask your question there. And of course, avforums.com, go there, go to the forum list. All the way down the bottom of the forum list, you'll find the AV Forums podcast threads in the forum there. Go there, find this one, ask your question, and we'll answer it in the next Home AV podcast. But that's it for this one. My thanks to the guys today. Thank you very much for your time, guys.
Cheers, Phil.
Thanks, Phil.
Our next episode will be the movies and TV show edition with Kaz and the team on Monday, the 22nd of April. That's followed by the 4K and Blu-ray show on the 25th of April. And also, don't forget that this month is the first month with the Extra Monday, which means we get a gaming podcast, the first ever gaming podcast of 2024. So join Ian and the team and be extra nice to Ian. He's taken up the reins after not having presented a podcast in a long, long time. He used to do it a long, long time ago. But join him and the games team for our first ever one. It'll go live on the 29th of April, and all of those podcasts are available from 7 p.m. on the AV Forums podcast YouTube channel. So that's not the AV Forums channel, it's the AV Forums podcast channel. Head over there for 7 p.m. and find the latest episode. And then, of course, on your audio only versions will be available via your podcast subscribers or subscription. Right, that's about it. If you want to buy us a coffee, then you can buymeacoffee.com/AV Forums. Of course, Patreon and all the rest of the links are available. I'm Phil Hinton. Thank you very much for watching and listening, and we'll see you in the next one. Goodbye.